Trigger warning, friends. Today's episode contains frank discussions of mental health disorders, depression, anxiety, and suicide. If you have been affected by suicide in your life, and this is something that you would like to avoid, we'll see you next week. There are people who go their entire lives struggling to find their way out of a cave of anxiety, depression, and suicidal thoughts. And for anyone who's been around people who are like that, the stress can be overwhelming. When people sink down into deeper and deeper levels of depression and anxiety and suicidal thoughts, it can ultimately lead to suicide. Suicide is now the leading cause of death among young adults between the ages of 18 to 34, and the fourth leading cause of death among the middle age. Now, we know that just as a computer's hardware determines its foundational capabilities and its software determines how it interfaces with the rest of the world, human beings' hardware is tied to our biology, and our software dictates how we relate to ourselves and to others. Together, these two parts of our identity determine how well we function, what our limitations are, and what are our possibilities. We become the story that we have decided to live inside. When Jesus said, "I have come to set the captives free," he meant that he came to debug our programming and invites us to partner with him to bring all of those bugs to the surface and eliminate them. My guest today is Dr. Daniel Amina. He is the author of The Suicide Solution, a book that creates a conversation between a minister and a psychiatrist, informed by the clinical realities of anxiety, depression, and suicide. The authors draw on the transformational relationship strategies taught by Jesus to create a chart and a pathway into life and freedom. This is The Lindsay Elmore Show. Welcome to The Lindsay Elmore Show, a podcast for people who deserve to be healthy, with honest, open, and enlightening conversations with doctors, thought leaders, creatives, and spiritual gurus. You'll walk away with simple and tangible tips and tricks that allow you to live your healthiest life so you can pursue your dreams, overcome obstacles, and leave your mark. Dr. Daniel Amina is a child, adolescent, and adult psychiatrist and associate medical director of Amen Clinics, a chain of nationally recognized outpatient healthcare clinics that have pioneered innovative techniques in mental health diagnosis and treatment. He's experienced in treatment of depression, anxiety, suicidal ideation, mood disorders, addiction, ADD, ADHD, impulsive disruptive behavior disorders, autism spectrum, psychotic disorders, OCD, PTSD, and TBI. Dr. Amina is a board member of the Center for Child and Family Development and a member of the One Hit Away Advisory Council. He is also a board member and a treasurer for the Extended Arms Initiative in Los Angeles, a nonprofit organization focused on homeless outreach and overseas medical missions. His debut book is entitled The Suicide Solution: Finding Your Way Out of the Darkness. Dr. Amina is married to his wife, Emily, and has one daughter. Dr. Daniel Amina, welcome to the Lindsay Elmore Show.
Thank you so much for having me. So excited to be having this topic and discussing this topic with you today. It's extremely important, yes. Especially in this time.
Absolutely. So, you know, listeners, today's conversation is going to involve frank discussions about suicide, suicidal thoughts, depression, anxiety. So if any of that is triggering for you, then we'll see you next week. And One of the things that I learned as I was researching your book is that suicide is now the leading cause of death among young adults between 18 to 34, and the fourth leading cause of death among middle-aged people. Those statistics are staggering and honestly frightening. And so what is it that leads you to believe that certain people, young people, middle-aged people, are so susceptible to suicide?
A great question. I know it's a very scary topic. My hope is that in our discussion today, actually, all of us will end with hope. It's often important to be able to define what the issue or the concern is before we can move towards resolution and then hope. So we'll be doing a lot of that today. As relates to your question, I actually want to clarify a point here. Between 10 and 34, it's a second leading cause. You know, usually you're thinking of people accidentally getting hurt is which ends up being the first leading cause of that. The issue or the concern is that the trajectory, the pace of increase, it's increased about, 35% in the last 20 years, and it hasn't really been slowing down. The concern is that with this current pace, it is going to be the leading cause of that, right? In psychiatry, it's the thing that we watch out for, the thing that we try to prevent, right? If you're an oncologist or cancer doctor, you try to prevent people dying from the cancer. In psychiatry, we try to prevent people dying from a mental illness, right? So to answer your question here, it really starts with most suicides and completed suicides in particular. It's more than 9 in 10 have some sort of mental illness related diagnosis. Now, in our clinic and in this book, we redefine that term mental illness. We discuss it in a context of what we call brain health. So we think of it more as a brain related condition that causes a symptom that leads to someone not wanting to be alive, that leads to someone eventually choosing to end their life. So we see this more as brain-related conditions. Now, taking it even further to better answer the question of like, why are certain people more susceptible? It relates back to that, understanding that there's a biological consideration that actually puts some people to be more vulnerable. That's in relation to how their genetics set them up. There's genes that can unfortunately influence your risk for suicidality or even just at baseline depression, anxiety, and other conditions. But then we already know that, you know, life experiences, the traumas and such, and not only the experiences, but how we process those experiences, how we learn from them and learn in good or bad ways, how our neuroplasticity helps us or doesn't help us. That's the other part of plasticity we don't often talk. Brain can do things in unbeneficial ways at times too, right? So it ends up being this combination of vulnerabilities, some genetics, life experiences, the traumas, the interior narrative we start to develop, which is something we talk about in the book. We'll talk about this more today, but hardware and software eventually leading to that right mix of what I call the perfect storm of triggers and vulnerabilities leading to a suicide attempt.
So I love what you're saying, because we've talked a lot on the show with Dr. Erica Gray, for example, about how our genes don't define our destiny. And we've talked with Michael Mrzenich about the power of neuroplasticity, as well as Carol Garner Houston, about how the brain can wire itself in good ways. But one of the things we really haven't talked about is how the brain can wire itself in bad ways, which is what you were just saying. So talk to us about how you understand neuroplasticity to work, and how having the biological situation, some triggering traumas, can lead to these, I don't want to call them faulty, but these brain patterns that are not serving us well.
Beautiful question. And I'm so glad you've already had these thought leaders on already on your show. So you've introduced your your listeners to these topics, right? I do believe it's extremely important that we become more well-versed on what the brain is capable of and how to care for our brain. I tell my clients, no one is born with an operating manual. We pop out and we're just basically trying to figure it out, right? And our parents have some idea. We try to, you know, we try to impart some knowledge into our children, but the reality of it is their brain can come together a little bit different and it can influence how they see and process their world. That element there, unfortunately, can open us up to areas of vulnerability. So in the book, we talked about hardware and software. The reason we use that analogy is that it helps us kind of frame this very difficult discussion on the brain, right? The hardware element is that biology, right? It's the biology of the brain. When you think of those neurons, how they're firing, how those pathways are being created and strengthened and even weakened over time. And then the software is the psychology, the part that's always being updated, kind of like our phones, kind of like our computer systems. They're consistently being updated with new data, right? Along the way, you can get bugs in either of these areas. You can get a bug in the hardware. You can get a bug in the software. Now, these bugs may have been there for a useful reason initially. So we talk about the idea of, let's say, if someone has dealt with a lot of early life trauma, what is the first thing the brain recognizes? The world is not safe. The world is not safe, then let me create strategies for protecting self. Let me assure that the way I relate to the world keeps me safe. Let me not be trusting. Let me not put myself out there. Let me be defensive. Let me be ready for the threat, right? Automatically, that's turning up your threat detector. That's turning up your potential anxiety levels already, just because it was necessary. It practically kept you safe and alive, maybe even when you were younger. Now, the issue that skill set that your brain developed and honed, right? The hardware being honed and strengthened along the way, and the software that fits in with that hardware to look for that threat gets stronger over time. And your brain attempts to apply that same knowledge base to new situations. This is how we manage threats. This is how we look for threats. And it continues to attempt to do that. Now, the issue is that may not always serve you well. It may impact the quality of your relationships. It may impact the appropriate risks that you take as far as like the jobs you go out for. It may impact your overall growth and development. And unfortunately, it may impact your health, right? Because if your brain has set you up into a state of threat detection all the time, stress and threat management all the time, or just baseline increased anxiety, anxiety increases inflammation. Anxiety is chronically damaging to the body. You know, we talk about cortisol and such. So neuroplasticity is a wonderful thing in itself, in the sense that it helps the brain learn and grow and evolve. It's not completely static. But the issue is that the brain can learn not the best habits also, and it can continue to repeat those. And sometimes it can become challenging to change that. The beauty of neuroplasticity is a two-edged sword, right? So you can change your brain, which is always the hope statement. It's like, okay, my brain isn't done. Okay, it's doing this. It's been doing it all my life. I'm 40 and 50 or whatever. But it doesn't mean your brain is stuck like that either. It does mean it's going to take an intentional process though, right? Because your brain is going to reward that neuronal pathway, that bundle of neurons that fire a particular way. It's like, we already know this works. The brain's just going to love using that. And you're going to have to build up a neuronal pathway that's different, that's maybe more positive, that's more trusting and such.
Yes, absolutely. You know, we think of our brains as being very smart, but our brain's true nature is about survival. The most basic primal instinct of the brain is to survive. And so you're so right. Those adverse childhood experiences that we carry with us for years and years, you have to be very intentional about unwinding that mental mess, because your brain is actually trying to protect you. It's actually trying to say, we are safe here without going through this change. And that is one of the reasons that change is so very difficult. Now, what do, and another thing I loved about what you just said is that anxiety drives inflammation. If the main cause of human suffering is not inflammation, I don't know what it is. It's just, it drives everything that goes awry in our body. And there's no condition that inflammation does not make worse. And so you have a new book called The Suicide Solution, Finding Your Way Out of the Darkness. And I'd love to talk about, you know, is suicide truly preventable in any individual? If someone who is listening either is having suicidal thoughts themselves or knows someone who is, how do we prevent suicide from happening?
So number one, to that individual who's listening, there is hope. Yes, suicide is preventable. Yes, it is, irrespective of your situation. And in no way do I want to minimize anyone's situation. I've been working in this field long enough now that I know people have gone through things that we could never even imagine, right? That they don't even feel comfortable even fully discussing. So I know that there is so much that may impact someone's hope in just that baseline. But nevertheless, I do firmly believe that there's hope for anyone. And that's really one of the reasons we wrote this book. It's, we need to look at things differently. We need to be educated in just how our brains work. We need to be open to have these discussions, because if we choose not to have these discussions, unfortunately, then it stays hidden and it actually creates more fear and it creates more stigma to even this particular topic. There is hope. There are multiple ways to actually get to a place of wellness. And it's often actually is one of the reasons we use this finding your way out of the darkness. It's finding that guide and walking that path. It's not that it's a snap your fingers thing and you're just there. It's not one medicine, one magical supplement. It's not just one particular thing. It's a lifestyle that breeds and creates wellness.
And so what does this lifestyle look like?
So it's intentional. That's the first part. Okay. It's intentional. But to be intentional, you need to have an understanding of how things are working. So we actually, that's how we start. We start in the first 3-4 chapters basically discussing how our brains work, how we understand our environment, how we understand ourselves. We talk a little bit about the hardware element, like this brain part and the things that can impact it. And this is actually such an important piece here. Your hardware, your brain biology can be what's making it hard for you to be happy. Okay. It doesn't mean that you're weak mentally. It doesn't mean that you have poor habits and you can't figure it out. Or, you know, we particularly wrote to people who have some kind of fate beliefs, but we believe this book has benefits for people who don't have some kind of fate background. But even in people with fate structures that speak against suicides and such, they will often feel like, oh, it must mean that I don't have enough faith. I'm not a good enough practicer of my whatever religion it may be. And often, sometimes it has nothing to do with that. It just has to do with the fact that biologically, oh, you had a head injury.
Yes, you've had 15 concussions in your life. Like, that can be a major change to your brain's biology.
Two concussions drastically, actually just even one concussion drastically increases your risk for a suicide attempt. Just one concussion. And think about all the people out there who are like, oh, I just saw some stars or whatever. We see this all the time at our clinic. The more hits to the head, the more risk for depression and anxiety. It changes the biology of the brain. It literally changes parts of your prefrontal cortex that help regulate your emotional brain, parts of your prefrontal cortex that help weigh reward, that help figure out how to problem solve. It changes parts of your limbic brain, or specifically in your amygdala. Your amygdala is always about threat detection. It's thinking about the worst case scenario. There's a part that's actually looking for the lion in some ways in your environment. If there's injury because you had a head injury or such, that part starts firing off inappropriately.
Mm-hmm.
It starts looking for threat inappropriately, looking for too many lions in particular situations. And then it shows you the worst case scenario, which is death.
Hmm.
Right. And you're like, why is my brain throwing this at me? You know, some people, it shows up as kind of these intrusive recollections, intrusive thoughts on death. Some it's, it shows up more passively over time, or some it's a learned habit. They start thinking about this thoughts. But really the management element of it starts with recognizing that, okay, there are parts that I need to work on. If I've been doing a great job on my faith practice, if I've been doing a great job on my diet, my exercise, and all these other pieces, I'm eating right, I've been doing therapy for years, but these thoughts keep coming up. We need to look at the biology, right? So that's actually one of the things we talk about in the book, about really doing a better job on understanding the biology of the hardware of the brain, the things that may have led to poor functioning or inadequate functioning. Mm-hmm. That's, I only gave one example of head injuries, but even mold toxicity, Lyme, they've published it. It's not even controversial. If you have Lyme disease, your risk for depression and anxiety, or even suicide attempts, doubles and triples, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just, we already know this, right? So infectious processes can impact the brain. Head injuries can impact the brain. And those are just on the biology side. If you have a chronic inflammation from some other random condition, mm-hmm. a thyroiditis or whatever it may be, that impacts the brain. If you have a food allergen that you haven't been taking care of, that impacts the brain. If you have sleep apnea and you're not treating it, that impacts your brain. So we start with that basic understanding that, look, this is a part that needs to be assessed too. If you're having these kind of recurrent thoughts, there's things you need to do to make sure you're assessing that and adequately treating that. And it's okay to treat that. It's not a matter of weakness. If you need to take a prescription or a medication or a supplement or whatever, or change your diet or something to fix that, then please do it, because it's the biology. Mm-hmm. It's what your brain needs.
Mm-hmm.
Then we jump up from there, and we now talk about this concept. We call it understanding your story, which is understanding your self narrative. Okay, your self narrative is another way for us to say your software, right? I think therefore I am, in some ways, right? So if I know myself as, this is me, I am the hero in my own story, or am I the victim in my own story? And how does that continually show up in life? We talk about a concept called schemas. We go through and give a lot of different examples of what that looks like. It can be schemas of mistrust, of deprivation. There's multiple different ones, and it can just frame the way we look at our world. Right? Mm-hmm. If we feel that the world is not safe and that's part of our schema, then it's going to frame how we look at different relationships and encounters and opportunities. Knowing this then leads you to potentially make changes, right? You can't change what you can't measure. So that's actually the first part. Have a better understanding mm-hmm. of what's going on, then start the process of measuring it, writing it out, and then be intentional about actually making change in it. Then mm-hmm. the last half of the book, which is almost 8 chapters or so, is really just going into the menu of options. This is the stuff you discuss on your show. It's how are you living a life intentionally that supports your brain health, your emotional health, your mental health. I'll talk about this more later, but there's a concept I like to share with my clients. It's called the 4 C's. Being able to live intentionally by being creative, connecting with others, contributing to others, cultivating a lifestyle of wellness, and helps us live more wholly, right? Live in a way that perpetuates life. There's also a bigger concept, which we'll talk about a little bit later too. It's just this idea of, if we're intentional about our lives, we can almost create our own mission statement, like we were a company, right? So instead of focusing on what I have done wrong, or man, I'm using my schema again, here's that cognitive distortion again my therapist told me about, it ends up being, this is the kind of person I want to be. This is how this person is. And I review this. I meditate on this every day. And I continue to work on living this out. And there's a exercise in the book that kind of really talks about this and making sure that you actually write it out, because it becomes a super important portion of being intentional in our living.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So there was so much in there, and I want to go there. I want to go all the way back to the concussions, because I also really want the audience to understand how research can be so biased depending on who is funding the research. And in the book, The Triumph of Doubt, there is an entire chapter dedicated to how the NFL manipulated research to show that concussions do not cause brain damage and that repeated head injuries, such as those sustained when you play NFL football, cause no damage. But you look at these guys that were just these, you know, beefy, brawny guys that had one of the most aggressive jobs on the planet. Their brains shrivel down to nothing as they age. And it's horrifying that because of industry interests that we ignore what is almost obvious to us. Of course, banging your head repeatedly is not good. Not good for, it's just like, I remember when I was in high school, one of my teachers was like, guys, you who's out there is smoking cigarettes? I know some of you are. You're in 10th grade. And he said, you're literally burning a plant and inhaling it into your lungs. How does that compute? And that doesn't even get into all the additives in cigarettes, but that's a story for another day. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsors. SomaVedic is the ultimate EMF protection. It is designed on the principle of controlled release of energy from precious and semi-precious stones. This allows you to create a coherent field covering more than 2,800 square feet. That's right. It forms a bubble of protection against electromagnetic frequencies, including 4G and 5G, Wi-Fi, and your cell phones, and it protects against oxidative stress and free radicals. The SomaVedic Ruby and the Vedic models are there to help repair cellular damage from non-native EMF exposure. It helps the body to repair itself from the harmful effects of EMF. The balancing effects reach a 100 feet radius in all directions. And that's not all. SomaVedic can also help to harmonize your water. SomaVedic creates structure in your water that helps it to benefit our bodies more. By creating hexagonal patterns, water is reorganized into its natural state, just like nature intended. You can head over to www.somavedic.com and use the code LKE to save 10% off. That's www.somavedic, that's SOMAVEDIC.com, and use the code LKE to save 10%. Be sure to shop using the code so that SomaVedic knows that we sent you. And now, let's get back to the show. The other thing you said is about the internal narratives of the victim versus hero mentality. I am a huge fan of Donald Miller's work. And Donald Miller says, if you're not the hero, you don't have a story. The victim is never the centerpiece of a movie or a book or a play, because the victim has no story, because they've given away their power and they are allowing other people to craft their life for them and not living intentionally, as you said. And writing it out, I think, has so much power, and creating a mission statement for your own life. listeners, I'm a huge fan of Tanya Dalton's work. She's been on this show twice. She's in episode 149, I know of, about how do you live on purpose and how do you create this life of purpose and stay focused on what's truly important to you. So after you finish The Suicide Solution, I encourage you to go pick up a copy of her book on purpose.
By the way, I love all that. And thank you for sharing in your own knowledge of it, because it's so important. I'm glad that you drove home that particular point. It's so necessary. We tend to live life by default. And unfortunately, when you live life by default, there's a tendency to fall back into those old narratives. Mm-hmm. Here's the thing about those narratives. You live into them. Even if you don't want to like accidentally live it, you just live into them. So if people have told you that you're faulty and they told you that early in life, that something's inherently wrong with you, you may not even consciously bring it up in your mind all the time. But if there's a default element to that where it's just back there, your brain will start looking for evidence to prove it. Mm-hmm. It will look for, you know, when you get, you know, that feedback at work, even if they had mentioned potentially positive things, you'll focus on the part that was negative, right? Mm-hmm. And then now frame your expectations in work, you frame your expectations in relationships. It changes your enjoyment of things. It actually subtly can start steering you away from the things that actually would feed you. You can go down such a long path, like the years later, and just feel lost. You're like, why am I even doing this job? Why am I even here? But the decision was made years before. Because of some vulnerability, some issue in a particular time, you said, okay, maybe I can't do this. Maybe I shouldn't be in this thing. And then you made the decision to go down another path, but it wasn't really where your heart was. It really wasn't where your giftings and your talents are. It wasn't in a place that refreshed you or made you feel whole, right? And unfortunately, this is what happens when we are not aware of who we are fully. We're not aware of our inherent value. We're not aware of the things that may make us more vulnerable. And then unfortunately, we start in default making these decisions that over the long haul impact the quality of our lives and impact our health. Mm. So I'm super passionate about the idea of living on purpose.
Absolutely. And I think what you just said is so beautiful. We aren't aware of our inherent value. I mean, that to me is just the downfall of humanity that each and every one of us is fighting against. That feeling of I have no value, I am unworthy of being loved, you know, things are terrible, so they'll always be terrible, and they're terrible in every way. And it does.
I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but this is so big. Again, that inherent value piece, if you can't find it in self, it's hard to find it in others. So it's going to impact how you treat others. Mm. And you can kind of see what's happening in societally, how we're treating others.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Just go online and just see how people don't feel a good sense of value in self. They don't know how to care for themselves. So what do? They spew their frustrations, their angers on others, and just poisoning people in many ways.
Absolutely. It's this spewing of poison. And another thing that's scary about social media is that's where kids are. That's where children and teenagers are. And it can be a very, very terrifying place for kids to be. I cannot tell you, I had a 10-year-old child reach out to me on Instagram and just be like, I love you, da da da. And I was like, hey, by the way, Instagram's a big place. If there's ever anything you don't want to tell your mom, I'm a safe adult. You can come tell me. And just like so terrifying. Having a teenager is scary. I was just having this conversation with a couple of friends of mine about teens that are having severe depression, severe anxiety, suicidality, and are just seem less equipped to deal with what is modern society. I mean, the human brain is not built to live like we live today. So what are the early signs that parents need to be on the lookout for And just put it to us plainly, how early can those signs start to show?
Depending on risk factors, those signs can show up really early. It's something we look, I'm a child psychiatrist also, so it's something we look out for early. I have some clients that come in at 4, 5, 6, 7. And it's not because their parents did something to them, right? Some situations it is, right? They were adopted and they have been through some really bad things. But for some kids, just biological genetic vulnerability can leave them open to certain symptoms. So they can start showing up quite a bit early, right? And imagine that, right? You're a kid who's barely learning ABCs and language, and you're trying to understand just basic elements of emotions and then naming those emotions and emotional control. But your expanded range of emotions also leads you to kind of a dark place. It's a very difficult thing for a kid to be able to manage and regulate, right? But that doesn't stop at 4, 5, 6, right? Even your now you're dealing with hormones. You're dealing with hormones changing that range of emotions again. But not only changing that range of emotions, but changing how you view and see yourself. Like your literal body is changing, right? You don't look and feel the same as you did when you started a decade out. Right, that second decade of life, it's profoundly challenging for the brain. It's an amazing, exciting time, but it's profoundly challenging. Doing this work long enough, you start to realize how many miracles happen just for us to be able to perceive reality, to be able to live into this world. There's like it's already a place of blessing in some ways when most of our bodies work. We take it for granted. Okay, we do take it for granted, but if you're someone who's most things work, okay, or you mostly perceive, I'm not saying everything has to be perfect, can have some differences, whether it's physical or learning or such, but if even with those, there's so much that had to go right for your body to even work and for you to even perceive reality or even listen to us having this discussion right now, right? It's a miracle in itself, but that starts from a place of gratitude that changes things. Now, going forward as to your concern with social media, I have a huge concern with it. It is a huge point of trigger. You know, there used to be said what it takes the village to raise their child. And that's a true thing. It's not just the parents, right? You want good, healthy other community that speaks into the life of the child, that speaks into the life of a child, a healthy narrative. But here's the challenge. During the period of the most flexible neuroplasticity or the most vibrant, vigorous neuroplasticity. So the most vigorous is probably between like 1 and 7 or so. But you still have just your brain is doing a lot between 7 and 25. Okay. You can have passive neuroplasticity, which is you're just picking up stuff. Okay. And then there's active too. Active is your intention, learning something, you're learning math or whatever, you're learning language, things like that. So they can be active as passive. Post 25, the passive kind of dwindles and mostly goes away. That's why after 25, it really becomes intentional to shift our way of thinking. Okay. That's why it can be so hard, but it's still doable. I'm going to emphasize that. In those younger ages, they're passively picking up stuff. And it's not just this curated safe community anymore. It's the world. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you'll see how many young people I meet with now that have these concerns about some awful thing that's happening somewhere in the world. And the truth is, it's great. They have compassion. And because of it, they might be the people who are more likely to go help others. Okay, that's great. I want all that. But can you imagine carrying that burden already? Like all you do is just turn on your phone as like awful happening, right? Last year, they started calling doom scrolling. We were just all doing that all day. Doom, 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 bad, bad, bad. Of course, you're going to want to be miserable. Your brain's going to go, bad data point. Here's anxiety hormone, neurotransmitters and hormones. Another bad thing, anxiety hormone. They might not even have anything to do with you. And that's even worse because then your brain feels like it doesn't have a locus of control over it. Oh, it is. He has a bonus 25% extra anxiety because of you have no control over this thing. Here you go. Here's more all day long. So they're getting bombarded with that. But then they're also dealing with a social structure where they're having an influence from others outside who are critical, who are shaming, who are belittling, who create unrealistic expectations whether that's how they look, what they have. They create these viewpoints of, oh, if I don't have that, then there's something wrong with me. If I don't look that way, there's something wrong with me. If I don't have this relationship, there's something wrong with me. They start to find ways to try to define themselves based on, and it's a natural thing. During development, you start to kind of test out who you're going to be in some ways, right? Especially during those teen years. But now it's not always positive influences. Mm-hmm. So it unfortunately opens them up to this increased stress, increased demands, this hyper-connected state. Their brains are always on. The brains don't have time for their creativity, the rest that they need. And of course, depression, anxiety goes up. So what the parents should start watching out for, first things first, is most things are fixed in the context of relationship. Okay, so just, I mean, if we're doing like behavioral plan for a child or something, it's really, okay, what's the relationship like between parent and child first? What can we do to even fix that first? Because it changes how the behavioral plan will be implemented. Right. So most things are fixed in the context of relationships. So it's, how's the relationship going? Do you guys just need to do a road trip? Just go on a road trip, you know, find some way where you're forcibly in a situation where you have to kind of build and nurture a relationship, even and just nurture it daily. Practice it. Put your phone down at dinner. Everybody just put your phone down. Everybody just, let's make it a thing. Let's still try to have a meal where we eat and we don't have the TV on. Mm-hmm. But we just check in on each other. They're going to be annoyed in the beginning. They'll be annoyed about it. Of course, that's what teens will do, but do it for a couple of months. Make it a thing where you check in. Make it a thing where you also talk about gratitude. Model gratitude, right? Mm-hmm. And model listening. What often happens is with all parents, I'm a parent, but I'm not just a parent of a two-year-old, but I can already see it in myself. I have to watch for it, is that sometimes we just have to let them process by talking. Hmm. We don't have to give them the answer right away. Mm-hmm. Frankly, if we give them the answer, try to solve it or try to make it all better right away by ourselves, it actually decreases their confidence in their own ability to be able to manage that stressor.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And you know, what you're saying sounds very much like the Gottman method that couples use, where... So Dr. Gottman and his wife are world famous relationship experts. And he says that if you're going to have a successful relationship, you have to every morning and every evening check in with your partner and be genuinely interested in what they have to say and genuinely listen to them. So, you know, start your day with your children or with your spouse or with your loved one and just say, what's your day look like? How is this going to go? Let's, you know, what are you looking forward to? What are you nervous about? And then at the end of the day, you have that moment of like, how did that thing you were nervous about go? Like all in that reflection. So that, and a 6-second kiss every morning and every evening is, Dr. Gottman's like, you're going to stay married and you're going to stay in these open and communicative relationships. And so
let's sit in that for a second, because it sounds so simple, but the truth is it's hard, right? I mean, I know it, you know it. I try to practice that, but do I get it right all the time? No. So we don't beat ourselves up. We all know it. We're not going to necessarily get it perfectly all the time. But when you get these reminders, you go, okay, yeah. I got to make sure I do it tonight. I'm going to knock it out of the park tonight. I'm going to knock it out of the park. And then just continue to try to do your best. And then be in this, if you're intentional about it, you're having these check-ins, right? Mm-hmm. Listening to a podcast like this is about being intentional about your own growth and your own development and your own learning. Right. And it reminds you to go, oh, yeah. I want to be working on this. I want to be continue to grow in this, because that's how we get better. That's a life of wellness, right? Mm-hmm. Nurturing, growing, learning, and improving our relationships. But again, it's on purpose. It's intentional.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, if parents have kind of lost touch with their children, you know, maybe they've got some tweens, some teens, you know, how do you start to craft this? And maybe they've got some evidence that their child might be depressed or might have suicidal thoughts. How do parents raise children aware that suicide is preventable. How do you, without scaring your child, but without, you know, there's a spectrum of I ignored this and my child committed suicide, and then I'm scared the crap out of them on the other end of the spectrum. So how do you find that mid ground where children feel like they have so much support that they just inherently understand that if I get into that very dark place, I have people who will help get me out?
Actually, let me add another group to the examples you just mentioned. There's this other group where it's the parents is like, we didn't see this coming. And it's not like they were like not, there were parents that didn't talk to their kid or anything. They actually talked to their kid. They're good parents. They have good relationships, but we didn't see, it just feels like it came out of the blue. And I've heard that example. You can go, you know, there was even a recent story I just read about that. There's that example also shows up. And I think that's, there's an element of that that's societal in some ways, that it's difficult to have those conversations in general of mood illness, depression, anxiety, because many of us just want to look like our Instagram image, right? Our Instagram life, that everything's all great.
Oh, yes.
Our kids get along great, where our house is clean.
Yeah.
Our hair's done, you know, I don't have to worry about the hair thing, but our hair's done right, you know, all of it, right? But the reality of it is that we do have all our struggles, but we sometimes aren't as open with having those discussions. So here's how it starts. I usually say for, you know, when a parent has a concern with the kid, is actually do a check-in with self first. Gauge where you're at. That's so important. Just gauge where you're at. Just write down like, okay, what are my worries? What are my concerns? What's going on with work? How am I managing it? And then really that, how am I managing the thing? Focus on it. Am I intentionally managing it in some ways, or am I just kind of just putting it in a box? Because when you put things in a box, you're modeling putting things in a box. Okay. You're modeling what they call a white knuckling it, right? I mean, yes, there's a strength to that, but it's not always adaptive. And it actually can be potentially problematic if you're doing it over a long period of time. Because we don't teach the problem solving, we don't teach the distress tolerance, that, and we don't teach reaching out for help if we're not doing it ourselves, right? Because it's one thing to say, hey, you can talk to me, but I've never communicated I've ever had an issue. Or I've never communicated that I would even know how to manage the issue beyond just telling it, well, you're doing it wrong. That's why. Right? So after hearing you're doing it wrong a couple of times, people are going to go, okay, now I'm fine now. They will have that response. So often it starts with a place of check in, see where you're at, see how you're managing your stresses and such. Because here's another thing for my creative, talented, entrepreneurial, but also very artistic, but also very sensitive clients, they can pick up on the emotions of others. If you're coming into that, into a conversation with them, it's like, how are you doing? Is everything okay? But you're bringing anxiety, you're bringing fear. They don't want that around them. They're already feeling it themselves. They're going to reject it. They're going to go, no, I'm good, leave. Why are you here? They're going to push you away. And then you can be like, I tried to talk to them. They said nothing was wrong. They were just mean to me.
Yeah.
First, it becomes often about how am I taking care of myself? How am I modeling health? And then approaching in peace and listening. Now, obviously, if someone's saying I'm going to kill myself and you saw some note or whatever popped up, take them to the ER, get care right away. Even it's better to err on the side of caution, because not only is it an err on the side of caution, it's saying we are always here. If we hear that kind of thing, we're always here. Right. It's I really emphasize this particular point. Don't say it's just a phase. Don't say it's just suck it up and deal with it and get through it. It'll be okay. Sometimes saying it'll be okay too quickly, or just people feel dismissed. It's like, well, they don't want to hear me. Yeah. Sometimes just being able to go, I hear you. Yeah, what you told me is happening with your boyfriend, and what you're dealing with your friend over here, and that teacher, what they did, or what happened at work, or whatever it may be, that mix of things. I hear you. It sounds awful. It sounds really, really tough.
Yes, because it goes back. It goes back to acknowledging someone's inherent value. If you are sitting with someone and you say, I see you and I hear you and I love you and I don't have the answers for you all of the time, but we're gonna figure this out. Like, it acknowledges the profound miracle that is life on earth that we all get to experience in this time and place, even though this time and place is very, very stressful and overwhelming, and mental health disorders have soared over the past few months because, as you mentioned, it goes against our basic nature of needing the creativity, the connectedness. We need that cultivation of lifestyle. And when that was stripped away, we unfortunately saw the stripping away of a lot of people's mental health. I mean, I am not immune to this. I moved out of New York City because I was like, not staying here. Like, this is poisoning me. It's terrible. So let's wrap up. Go ahead.
Sorry, just real quick on that. I call it a formula for health. Some of us had accidentally come up with a good formula of like, okay, these are the things I do, and people are like generally okay. And then in the context of COVID and the rapid change to our lifestyle and such, a lot of those were stripped away. And people went through months of just trying to figure it out. It's like, wait, I don't feel good. Why don't I feel good? And because they hadn't intentionally noted that, oh, you know what? Those times when I go hang out with my friends, those times when we have that one date night or movie night, those times when I play music or I go for more runs, I go to the gym, those are really important for my mental health. Oh, wow. I need to do all of those things. And it's almost like a formula. It's again, I don't like to simplify it as formula, but it really kind of is like that. It's like, I got to do these things. These are the things that are part of my operating manual. If I'm not doing these things, I am not happy. And that's, again, relates to the book and how we kind of think of it, is that it's not one thing that makes someone not suicidal. The other name I wanted for this book was just like, or at least tagline, was A Way to Live. Because in reality, it's not really about just suicide prevention. It's just a way to live, right? If we all lived by it, I mean, we could just redo it and just say it's about a lifestyle. Because in many ways, it just really is that. If you create a lifestyle, you're intentional about the lifestyle that your brain and your particular body needs, you're significantly more resilient to depression, anxiety, suicidality, and a lot.
I've said it so many times on the show, guys, I'm going to blow the punchline yet again. If it doesn't come down to the way you eat, the way you stress, the way that you heal infections, the way that you sleep, the people you surround yourself with, the toxins you expose yourself to, if it's not coming down to some of those things, and if it's not nutrient deficiencies or nutrient excesses, and if it's not lack of exercise, it's all of those root causes of every single disease known to mankind. So take us out and just give us a powerful story of hope and transformation that one of your patients has been through.
Yeah, actually, one of my favorite patients, in the book, we named him Zane. Interestingly enough, he didn't know that, at the time, he sent me this kind of summary of where his journey had been. And he didn't know I was writing the book at the time. So it was just kind of like this fortuitous thing. And so I was like, do you know how good this is? Do you mind if I share it in the book? And Zane had been dealing with depression, anxiety, severe suicidality. One of the reasons we actually include this story in the book is because I wanted people to be able to see that, oh, okay, if it can work for someone who's dealing with like this level, okay, this can work for me, right? I'll just give you a short excerpt of some of the things he had said in his words that he sent to me. I'm just going to read a little note here. He said, "There were days I had to tell myself, if I get through the day and I don't take my life, then it is a victory. If I don't buy the gun, if I don't use that knife, if I don't jerk the steering wheel into incoming traffic, if I don't hang myself, if I don't put the hose in my car's tailpipe, if I don't go to the garage and start the car, if I don't jump off the cliff or overpass, if I don't swallow all those pills, then it is victory. Can you imagine that? Like literally every day, you're just thinking to that level of depth of intensity.
Well, it's horrifying because you think about someone who is an addict and it's like, if I get through this day without drinking, it's a victory. This guy is like, if I avoid infinite numbers of ways that I can end my life, it's you hear in that desperation that he has thought about every worst case scenario. Everyone.
Thoughts jumping into his mind. And one of the ways he worked through its wellness, and he'd been working with therapists, doctors, and such before me, and he had already made a lot of progress before he and I even started working together. We just tweaked some things towards the end. But one of his things that really helped relates actually as much as we had to do biologically, because he had biological things we needed to work on, right? But his also related back to his narrative. He had to kind of change that internal narrative. He writes that he started to think of himself as an overcomer. The fact that I've survived all of this shows that I'm a survivor. He resonated with this phrase, like, survival is victory. Hope is my weapon against us. He found different ways to reach out. He is a person of faith to use things like scripture and such to almost do a reprogramming in some ways. So he would meditate on those. And this is what I actually, even for my non-faith-based clients, I'm like, write down what you actually want to be thinking about. I know your brain's telling you all this other stuff, but write down the things that you actually want to be thinking about, the beliefs that you want to have for yourself, and just reread those ones. Read that in the morning, read that at night, read that when you got a break, play it on a little tape or something. And it may seem silly, but really what we're trying to do is that the neurons that can feed those negative thoughts, they're powerful. They've been working out every day. Your neurons for positive thoughts aren't yet. We got to work them out. Mm-hmm. We need to start getting some of these thoughts, these quotes, these mantras, these scriptures of your true self, of your inherent value. We got to repeat that so much so that that becomes strong enough to fight back against those negative thoughts and such that come up. But his journey is one that has always resonated with me, and it proves the point of the importance of being able to work on that biology, work on that psychology, work on that software element of things, put it all together. And someone even with the most severe level of suicidality can have victory, can consider himself a victor.
I love it. I mean, the words we speak over ourselves and others become reality. And this is, you know, I have a long history of helping people quit smoking. And that's one of the things that we talk to people about is, like, you need to tell yourself that you're stronger than the nicotine. How do you craft that narrative of, if, you know, I can think about a cigarette, but I don't have to smoke one. And that's exactly what you're saying. So, listeners, I hope each and every one of you go and pick up a copy of The Suicide Solution, Finding Your Way Out of the Darkness, even if you're not having suicidal thoughts, because as we discussed, it is simply a lifestyle. Dr. Daniel Amina, thank you so much for coming in today and being a guest on The Lindsay Elmore Show.
Thank you, Dr. Elmore. This has been a privilege. I am so impressed by the community you formed, the message that you provide, the education you provide to your listeners, the hope. It's profound, and I feel so fortunate to have been part of today. Thank you.
Well, thank you for joining the community. If you've been struggling to feel your best and feel like that food, sleep, relaxation, none of it is truly working, maybe you need to up your game with some infrared light and negative ion therapy. Infrared light penetrates deep into your body, going through your skin to muscles, nerves, and bones. Infrared light then helps to boost local circulation, bringing oxygen and anti-inflammatory molecules, as well as flushing away toxins. Therefore, infrared heat has been shown to reduce muscle pain, joint pain and stiffness, arthritic pain. It also helps to reduce stress and fatigue and supports the immune system. Negative ions act as attractors to bacteria and allergens in your environment, and they can help to inhibit free radical oxidation as well as reduce exposures to heavy metals, viruses, and other harmful elements, and can help to balance the body and the mind. The Amethyst Biomat is specifically designed to help provide infrared light as well as negative ions by electrically charging a mat full of amethyst crystals. It truly is an amazing experience to lay on a biomat. I have one as well as the tourmaline and amethyst pillow, and they have become part of my daily relaxation routine. If you want to get one of your very own amethyst biomats, head to lindseyelmore.com/biomat and you can be on your way to relaxation and less stress and fatigue throughout your day. Head to lindseyelmore.com/biomat to shop now. The Lindsay Elmore Show is written and produced by me, Lindsay Elmore. Show segments are produced by Sue Procco and Derek Lugo. Sound design and editing is by Jive Media. Support The Lindsay Elmore Show by heading to lindseyelmore.com/podcast. Your contribution, no matter how big or how small, helps us to bring the best guests to the interview chair. Thank you so much for listening. Subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts. Share this and all of your favorite episodes with a friend and on social media. Be sure to tag at Lindsay Elmore Show and help us bring the pod to more people.